Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. Thank you for joining me for this later than usual edition of the Daily Wrap-Up today. I had a fantastic interview with Vanessa Beely from On the Ground in Syria, which is up live on the channel right now. But wait, don't watch it just yet. Stay tuned to this show because we have a lot of good information to go over today. In general, though, I wanted to make sure that you guys knew that in regard to the Syria topic and just about everything that we talk about on this show, and many of you in this chat and in this channel already are very, very acutely aware of what I'm talking about, but the understanding that what we see on the ground from actual people, be it Eva Bartlett, Vanessa Beely, or people like Hussein Al-Bukhadi on the ground in Yemen, very, very starkly contrast to what we're seeing from the mainstream media, and even the timing on which we get this information. When we're reporting on these stories hours, even days sometimes before the mainstream media discusses them, understand that is precisely because they are waiting for what they're allowed to talk about, how they're supposed to discuss it, and what they're supposed to give you and make you think while giving that information. Very important to understand. So I will, of course, have the interview from today with Vanessa Beely in the show notes of this video when I'm done. But in general, though, I recommend you watch that. And a lot of great information going on there. And today, of course, a lot of, I think, two or three follow-up stories in regard to the events of the recent attack in Syria and the downing of the IL-20 Russian plane. But before we get to that, the first story of the day, something that I cover a lot on this channel, haven't for a while now, but this one really stood out to me as something that not only is important for what's going on in this country and other countries for that matter, but that really ties back in many things we've talked about in the past in regard to a very hard topic to think about and discuss, which is human trafficking and child trafficking. This one coming from the freethoughtproject.com, entitled, "One of America's Largest Egg Producers Caught Using Child Slaves Given to Them by the U.S. Government." Now, that's a big title. And sadly, it's true. And the reality of what we're talking about here is not something that we have shied away from discussing and something that we've talked about a lot in depth over the years. Not just the reality that this happens, but the reality that it's happening in this country and that it's being covered up is a very big deal and something that we should all be paying very close attention to. Of course, with everything going on here and around the world, it's hard to find time to talk about and look at all of this stuff. But this is a very hard story, and this is something that's important to discuss. So this Monday, another suspect pleaded guilty to his role in human trafficking, in a human trafficking ring that took advantage of immigrant children and forced them into slave labor. 50-year-old Pablo Duran Ramirez Jr. is the fourth person, in fact, to plead guilty in this case, which involved a number of children being forced to work on an egg farm. He faces up to decades in prison at his sentence in January. Or sentencing in January. According to court records, a labor company named Haba Corporate Services, owned by Ramirez, arranged for trafficking immigrants to work with Trillium Farms, where they were physically threatened and forced to live in absolutely horrible living conditions. Trillium reportedly paid Haba $6 million for the immigrant workers. And you don't pay a price like that unless you know that you're doing something wrong for simply having people come and work for you or to set up the facilitation of the transfer of these illegal immigrants. Now, they were promised that they would be provided with jobs and education when they got to the States. Some of the workers were even as young as 14 years old. Sadly, they didn't get the education or the jobs they thought they were being lured here to do. Now, understand this very hot topic of immigration. And understand that we're talking about Americans trafficking in these people, bringing them in illegally under the guise of some kind of better future, and then putting them to work. So human trafficking and essentially slave labor. And child slave labor, understand, which makes it all the more worse. But any one of those things by themselves is a very big deal. Now, according to prosecutors, Ramirez was aware that these workers were children. And he also knew about the conditions and abuse that these children were exposed to. When the farm was eventually raided, federal agents found nearly 40 workers on the site. Now, this is something we've talked about a lot, actually, in regard to where they come from. Some of the workers at this farm were among the 1,500 immigrant children that were, quote, lost by U.S. border officials. During a subcommittee hearing on the investigation, Senator Rob Portman said the U.S. agencies were responsible for these children ending up in the hands of traffickers. Now, the article you're seeing there, we've talked about in the past, the reality that they lost them. But the question we should be posing is, were they lost or were they given to them? And in regard to the story, it seems more likely that they were simply given to them through this facilitation process. We've talked about even CPS, Children Protective Services, in regard to California, and then the title is different in other places. But the reality that these government groups have even admitted to the fact that many of the children that end up in human trafficking literally come from their groups, many of which we also reported were not actually even discussed. These children went missing, and these government institutions did not even report them missing. That is a massive red flag. And now we're talking about immigrant children, because obviously they get less attention, maybe not today, but had been historically, in regard to the simple idea of children going missing, especially when they're trafficked over from a country where there's no one going to be here that's going to say, hey, my child's missing. This is a very big deal. Now we have, actual congressmen speaking out saying, in fact, yes, the government is the very group that handed these people over to the traffickers. The Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations opened its inquiry after law enforcement officials uncovered a human trafficking ring in Marion, Ohio last year. Children as young as 14 had been in federal custody before being handed over to the traffickers by the government. He said, quote, it is intolerable that human trafficking, modern day slavery, could occur in our own backyard. This is Senator Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, of the chairman of the subcommittee. He said, quote, but what makes the Marion case even more alarming is that a U.S. government agency was responsible for delivering some of the victims into the hands of their abusers. Now, this is something that at one point, just even discussing this topic, was fake news, conspiracy theory. The fact that even the child trafficking exists sometimes is dismissed as a conspiracy theory. And we have talked about the idea of the classic concepts of, you know, Pizzagate, Pedogate, these discussions that have been around for a while now, which in many ways were hijacked by people that wanted to make them look fake. But the real story has always come back to the idea of pedophilia, child trafficking, in positions of power. People, there's the guy that literally just got sentenced, the one that worked on the Trump campaign, I believe his name was Shortley, I forget his last name, literally just got sentenced for child trafficking. We have the idea of someone like Dennis Hastert, who was, what, third in line to the president under George Bush, and literally was called a serial child molester and went to prison. This is not a conspiracy theory. These people in positions of power, in many cases, abuse that power to facilitate their disgusting habits. And understand that people find their ways into these positions to be able to do that. And understand today that it's much more prevalent than you may want to believe. And now, in fact, we're seeing a literal case where the government was involved in handing over the very people involved in this trafficking and putting them to slave labor, even as the country is turning beside itself about the immigration problem. Well, guess what? The government's involved. And understand, this happens, this dates well before the Trump administration. This is not a partisan issue. This is much bigger than that. So we will definitely continue to follow up on this and many others. But this is a story that you cannot turn your eyes away from. And understand that there's much more here than just some kids being handed over for slave labor. This goes much deeper than that. And I'll include some links in the show notes of stories we've touched on in the past. But it's important that you do your own research and see how deep this really goes. Moving on to the next story and getting into some follow-up into the story from yesterday in regard to the attacks on Syria, which was a very big deal and a very big escalation. Now, one point we haven't touched on yet, this one coming from Antimedia, entitled Major Attacks on Syria After Russia and Turkey Agree to Cancel Battle for Idlib. Now, this is the important point here is we haven't really touched on the demilitarized zone that was being discussed and how that plays into all of this. Again, all of which we discussed today in my interview with Vanessa Beely. But this is indeed an important development on how this all worked out. Now, immediately after Russia and Turkey announced that they've agreed to establish a demilitarized zone around Idlib, Israel chose to carry out a massive, unprovoked attack on Syria, which we covered yesterday as it was breaking. And we do, in fact, know for sure that it was Israel that carried out this attack. The only open question is whether or not France, from a frigate off the coast, or as well as the United States, were involved. As Russia has said that they have on radar a French firing missiles from the coastline. So whether or not that was involved in this is up for debate. But we know for sure that Israel was indeed the one that carried out these attacks. And the idea that Turkey's involved, I posed the question to Vanessa that maybe that was an entire smokescreen designed to allow this to be carried out. Who ultimately knows, as Turkey is clearly not on the side of Russia and Syria, but they tend to dance the line here, so it's hard to really tell. They shouldn't really be trusted as far as I'm concerned. But the reality here is that while this was about to take place, while Russia was literally saying, we're going to allow these people, even these bad terrorist groups, to vacate the area, which kind of goes against everything the mainstream media is saying about them, then Israel chooses to attack. Clearly, there's a reason for that. Now, according to Russian Ministry of Defense, the widely reported Russian offensive was essentially off for the time being. The planned offensive of Idlib was just off the table while this was happening. So the author rightly asks, with Putin negotiating for a world power de-escalation over Idlib after the U.S. threatened attack, was Monday's attack part of an Israeli and Western allies strategy for keeping regime change in Damascus on the table? Why escalate now? This, at the very least, appears a conscious effort to keep the fires burning in Syria, to prevent Putin from being in the driver's seat, and to continue to provoke hostilities with the Tehran-Damascus axis, and to further keep alive the possibility of the eventual military ouster of Assad. I completely agree with that. And of course, always saying just, oh, well, it's all Iran's fault. All of it, just ridiculously, even quoted, IDF has released tweets saying that we're sorry about everything, but this is Iran and Hezbollah's fault, which is ridiculous, I guess, simply because they exist. It's an absurd thing to put forward, but you can see their narrative very clearly coming through. Now that the ultimate circumstances were removed, that they apparently needed to carry out a false flag attack in Idlib, which would have been the Russian-Syrian offensive to retake it from the extremist control, it seems that they were ultimately trying to provoke a response, is what it seems like to me, which they could then have used as an excuse, playing the victim card, to attack Syria, as they've wanted to all along. It seems very apparent to me that this is the way this is playing out. But obviously, as always, come to your own conclusions. And the downing of the Russian IL-20 plane seemed like a clear effort to get that desired response. Moving to the next article coming from ZeroHedge.com, this one entitled, Russia Threatens Adequate Response Against Israel for the Downed Plane. So the Russian Ministry of Defense cleared up all the confusion around this story, the overnight downing of the Russian Illusion 20, I believe it's pronounced, the reconnaissance plane, when a spokesman revealed that Israel was indeed responsible for all of this, which resulted in the deaths of 15 Russian servicemen, which is a big deal. Now, according to the Wall Street Journal, the plane was accidentally brought down by an aging Syrian S-200 defense system, which has been confirmed, after Russia had scrambled its jets to respond to an attack by four Israeli F-16s on Syrian government targets. Israel notified Russia of its attack over a shared hotline, but it was only less than a minute before the beginning of the strike, giving the Kremlin basically no time to respond, which feels like was very intentional. They said, quote, as a result of the Israeli military's irresponsible actions, 15 Russian servicemen died, according to Defensive Ministry General Igor Konechnikov. Now, Israel's carried out roughly 200 strikes in Syria over the past year and a half, at which they surprisingly admitted to very recently, as they usually don't admit to any of these kind of strikes. And it ultimately is pushing back against what they claim is Tehran's growing presence in the area, which is always their go-to response. Now, Moscow has the right to as they're putting forward, respond adequately, which is a very interesting way to say that. But I think in ultimately it shows you the measured response to this, that they're going to respond, but it doesn't necessarily mean militarily. Now, there's many out there that think that that's a show of weakness, but I, in fact, think that it's the opposite. I think this shows a very measured and a lot of restraint in regard to things we've seen in the past. Imagine this in the reverse. Even something much slighter than this, the Trump administration likely would have already responded in kind with military action. But of course, having the largest military force in the world, it usually allows that kind of action. Now, it's important to see how this all plays out. And of course, this relates to coming into today with the newest article that we reported on earlier today, also coming from ZeroHedge.com, entitled "Moscow Accuses Israel of Using Downed Russian Jet as Cover During Syrian Attack." Now, any of those of you out there that keep attuned to the lastamericanvagabond.com website, you would have seen all of this earlier today, which is always the best place to catch our information as we share from other sites and ourselves to keep up on what's going on. But this information is from today. And this is the important development, as I see it, in regard to the way that this all was played out by Israel, very deceptively, using human lives, apparently, to carry out its agenda. Nothing new for Israel, as it goes. So while Russia had previously blamed Israel for the downing of this plane, which we just discussed, which resulted in the death of 15 individuals, the Ministry of Defense is now saying that Israel intended to use the Russian plane as cover during the attack. According to the Russian military, the plane was shot down while responding to an attack by four Israeli F-16s on Syrian government positions in the coastal town of Latakia. The attack was the latest of some 200 attacks, which we just touched on, which again, they surprisingly admitted to, over the past 18 months, which many people in the past have also called fake news. The simple fact that Israel has attacked, unprovoked, numerous times, and then some of them claiming it was Iran, but some of them not even addressed by the United States or the United Nations. Very revealing as it goes as well. Now, Israeli jets flew over the Mediterranean to launch the attack, only giving Russia less than a minute of notice, and of course, then commencing the strike. Now, this allowed the Russian military no time to pull the plane out of the way and its personnel out of the line of fire. A Russian spokesperson for the Ministry of Defense is saying that Russia believes the attack was set up this way, with the Israelis hoping to use the Russian plane as badly needed cover from Syrian air defenses. Since the Russian plane had much higher profiles than the Israeli planes, the Syrian defense systems would naturally latch onto it, the IL-20, and attack it as opposed to the Israelis' planes. They said, quote, "The Israeli pilot used the Russian plane as cover and set it up to be targeted by the Syrian air defense forces. As a consequence, the IL-20, which has radar cross sections, which is much larger than the F-16, was shot down by the S-200 system missile." So clearly acknowledging that Syrian forces did shoot down their plane, but making it very clear that not only was it Israel's fault, and not only did they set this entire thing up so that this could happen, but they did it all consciously. They planned all of this to be able to carry out this attack. And that is a big deal, which ultimately means it was their fault. These 15 Russians who died were as a result of Russia, or excuse me, of Israel. And that is what Russia is openly saying, which is a very big deal. I mean, this is an act of war. And people need to understand, like, really take a moment, as much as this is becoming normalized today, that this is a massive deal when we're talking about major nuclear powers, including Israel, despite the fact that they fail to ever acknowledge, the only country in the world that seems to be able to do that, that they actually have a massive stockpile of nuclear weapons. Open provocations between massive nuclear powers. This is a very big deal. It seems like it's being massively downplayed by much of the media, but interestingly enough, somebody comments on the fact that Glenn Beck on his show literally just basically said the story like I am, but then said, oh, but you know what? There's nothing we can do about it, so just forget about it. Literally saying, just forget about it, Americans. Not your worry. Don't worry about it. Except for the fact that U.S. is directly involved in this. This is a huge deal. Now, of course, after all of this, seemingly aware that they're trying to elicit a response from him, Putin simply stated, quote, "Retaliatory measures will be first and foremost aimed at additionally ensuring the security of our military personnel and facilities in Syria." He also stressed that, quote, these will be steps that everyone will notice. Very interesting. Again, saying adequately respond. This seems like a political move, which is very smart, knowing that they want him to respond so they can then cry foul, play the victim card, and simply attack anyway. It's interesting to see how this is playing out. Of course, if he were to respond emotionally in the past, he wouldn't be winning Syria like he is now. Very interesting development. Now, we will continue to keep an eye on all of this as usual and try to break in with any really big stories, even after late hours if it happens to be that way. But the reality here is that, as I see it, the United States, France, and Israel are all directly involved with creating what we're looking at. They very clearly want something. They've been talking about it incessantly for the last few weeks about Idlib, about Syria. If anything happens, we're going to attack. And then the moment that they discuss not attacking Idlib, like literally the same day, like probably within the same hour, when they're talking about a de-escalation, a demilitarized zone, Israel chooses to attack and strikes everything right back up again. These kind of correlations cannot be denied. They want a military escalation in Syria. As we've noted for decades, that has been the U.S. policy. And throwing and lobbing different excuses at you as it suits their narrative. Oh, it's Iran. Oh, it's ISIS. Oh, Assad's a bad guy. No, they just want to take over Syria. Very clearly. So stay tuned. I'm sure more will happen very shortly. And possibly these false flag attacks that we all know are coming. Again, make sure you tune into the Vanessa Bealey interview where we discuss all of this at length. And she is currently in Syria as we speak. Moving on to the next story coming from mintpressnews.com. This one very interesting and related to domestic policy and what's going on in this country. Entitled, "The U.S. Government's Secret Rules for Spying on Journalists Are Terrifying." And indeed they are, when you recognize what this is really about. With all of the nonsense going on today. Now, all this kind of stems from this topic, the FISA Act, the FISA memos, that nothing has happened around. This is a big deal, and now it's coming out. Something we've known for a long time. Again, just like we're talking about with the white helmets and different stories, all of a sudden people getting flabbergasted by, oh my God, they found out that that the Dutch government said, oh, they may be funding terrorism. No, we've been saying that for years. You guys know that if you're watching independent media. But plenty of people are still blinded by the propaganda, and stories like this are still terrifying and shocking. And they still should be terrifying and shocking. But the point is, we've been putting this out there for a long time. It's time we begin to wake up to the reality of what's going on and the governments behind it. So journalists and free press advocates are responding with alarm to newly released documents revealing the U.S. government's secret rules for using Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court orders, FISA court orders, to spy on reporters, calling the revelations important and terrifying. The documents obtained and released by the Freedom of the Press Foundation and the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University through an ongoing Freedom of Information Act, a FOIA Act, the lawsuit filed last November confirmed long-held suspicions that federal officials can target journalists specifically with FISA orders. The information highlights the very flimsy line that is very easily crossed with a FISA warrant, and how just about any journalist writing basically about any anti-establishment content can be swept up and surveilled by simply having connections. Ramaya Krishan, of a staff attorney from the Knight Institute, pointed out that, quote, a journalist merely being contacted by a FISA target, which in and of itself is a very flimsy thing, might be subject to monitoring. These guidelines, as far as we can tell, don't contemplate that situation or add any additional protections. The real point being, anything they essentially want. We've shown you that these warrants are signed, basically routinely given, regardless, just whatever they want. And we've known, dating back to the reality of the FISA memos, that this is what it stems to, that they get these warrants for basically anything. And people like ourselves, and of course, how easy would it be to label somebody like me a Russian bot? Or Assad apologist working with ISIS, whatever they want to try and say. I'm swept up and currently being surveilled. That's how this works. And of course, we've been pointing this out for a long time, but now we actually have documents that show just how flimsy this line is. Very revealing. Now, Veronica Barentensky, General counsel with the Center for Investigative Reporting said, quote, "It makes me wonder what other rules are out there and how have these rules been applied? The next step is figuring out how this has been used." Now, the sad realization to all of this is that the people making these calls and hiding these rules and using them however they want are the very people we currently see constantly caught up in scandal, lying, manipulating, cheating. Every day, this is what we're currently looking at. And these are the people making these decisions. It shouldn't be surprising to us that they're being abused or just flat out ignored. This is the reality of what we're staring at today. And the question arises to me now, with this, how this is being applied, is all of this ultimately a psyop? Like the way the media has been just ridiculous. The concept of no longer needing two sources, just regurgitating government news, just not, anonymous sources, anonymous op-eds with nothing. Is all of this designed to essentially create the context necessary for them to use what we're looking at to crack down on us? Very possible. That's how these things ultimately work. Also remember that with the latest installment of, Strzok's text messages, which is everywhere today, being, being handed down to you at the precise moment that they want your attention being pulled away from all these world events. All of this relates back to the FISA memo and FISA in general, and how none of these FBI criminals have to date been held accountable for their very, very clear and many crimes against the American people. As many of you know that have been watching the show from the beginning, I was counting days. How long all this talk about the FISA memo and how it was going to bring down our democracy or threaten our national security, and it did neither, and nobody ever got held accountable, despite the bombshell revelations. Think about that. And now the Strzok Lisa Page concept, all this FBI discussion, it's all just distracting you from the real point that they broke the law. And if maybe Strzok gets, hopefully something happens, but not just to him, to all of these people involved. But the reality is so much is going on behind this, and nobody ever gets held accountable where it matters. The real kingpins behind all of this, facilitating all of this, lying to you, working with the government, leaking stories to the media so they can then use those stories to carry out warrants. Very fraudulent acts that happen as a matter of policy. And now they're using it to surveil on journalists. This is the country we're living in today. It's important that we recognize how dangerous the situation truly is. Moving on to the final story of the day. Again, a story really highlighting the real nature of the people we're talking about today. This one, again, in regard to foreign policy, but in regard to a story that we haven't heard much about. Of course, as these stories, I always point out how it's interesting how these different hotspots tend to just take a moment off while we seem focused on something else. It's nice how ISIS has stopped acting out while we're focused on Syria, or vice versa, how North Korea and Kim Jong-un is Rocket Man has really stopped threatening everybody while all of a sudden we're focused on this. It's interesting how these things work. It's not that they stopped, it's that the media has stopped making you look at it. Important to recognize that. This one coming from antiwar.com, North and South Korea push to end Korean War. But U.S. opposes. No surprise there, because peace is not what they're out to get. Why they have a say on what these countries decide amongst themselves is beyond me, but clearly they do, and that's how they're applying themselves all around the world. So South Korean President Moon Jae-in arrived on Tuesday in the North Korean capital of Pyongyang for a third summit of the year between the two Koreas. While the other visits were highly aspirational, this summit has a much more direct goal, reaching a peace treaty. Moon was very frank about this, saying, quote, "What I want to achieve is peace, not a tentative change, which could be volatile, dependent on international situations, but irreversible, permanent, and unwavering peace, regardless of what might happen on the global area." That's a big statement. Now, clearly, he's saying without saying, regardless of what the U.S. does, I want this to happen, and now I'm focused on this. And that's a very clear sidestep away from the U.S. policy, which is a big deal. Now, that's likely to be difficult overall, with the Trump administration having made very clear repeatedly in recent months that they aren't willing to reach a peace deal yet, of course, and are intending to hold out. And it's essentially something that North Korea can only get after years of additional concessions, which is the way this always works. Give us everything before we consider maybe giving you something. North Korea has resisted giving up anything more without being certain that they'll get a peace deal. Ending the Korean War that began in the 1950s is exactly what he's out to get. Now, likewise, South Korea's President Moon has set himself up as wanting exactly such a deal, with or without the U.S. endorsement, it would seem. Now, this risks a split between the U.S. and South Korea. Even the U.S. is now even absurdly threatening sanctions against the South Korea for wanting peace and trying to lead its own affairs independent of U.S. demands, which should show us all, yet again, time after time, that this has nothing to do with peace for the United States, and that basically all countries of the past that were likely not national security threats or in need of some democracy by force, but were simply not playing ball with the United States empire and bending to its will. And maybe South Korea is the next country to be primed for the Libya model that John Bolton seems to think worked so well. But guess who it didn't work so well for? The Libyans. Thank you for joining me today. I will see you tomorrow for yet another edition of the Daily Wrap-Up. Stay tuned on this very channel for TLAV Research and Review, starting in just a few minutes on this very page. And as always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.